2016 taught us one thing. It's that anything can happen on election night.
268 to 204, so clearly an advantage for Secretary Clinton.
It also taught us not to trust polls, especially in the age of Trump. But is that true?
Look at all these wins we're projecting for Hillary Clinton right now.
Can we really not trust the polls telling us who's likely to win in November? Is it all just smoke and mirrors? If political polling is so inaccurate, why does the media report on each poll like it's a horse race, especially this far out from Election Day? Who can we even trust around here? This is why your predictions about the 2024 election are wrong. With the media reporting on new polling numbers ahead of the November election like it's a neck-and-neck horse race and not a presidential contest still 8 months away, it can be difficult to tell fact from fiction and to know how to interpret what you're reading. We'll talk about how to effectively interpret poll data later in this video, but while you're wading through poll news, my partner on today's video, Ground News, is a great place to start. I'm always really impressed with Ground News because they are genuinely a great resource for identifying biases in the media and your own biases and getting a bigger picture on the news so you come to your own conclusions, especially with the elections coming up. Ground News is a website and app that makes it super easy to stay up to date on the news, but in a way that gives you so much more context than a single source ever could. For example, a Wall Street Journal poll was just released and Ground News compiled over 65 sources on this story. You can follow along at ground.news/Legia. In Ground News, you can see all that coverage in one place, and they even provide a bias comparison of these sources. What I see here is only 18% of left-leaning sources are covering it, so you might have missed this story. Out of all those sources, you can see that there's a split mix of factuality. Ground News offers insights into the factual accuracy of these sources and reveals information about their funding, empowering you to draw your own conclusions. If you scroll down, you can compare headlines to see how narratives change depending on their bias, factuality, and ownership. You can see the right from Ohio Star says Trump leads Biden in 6 of 7 critical swing states, which has a positive spin on it. That's contrasted by the left's narrative from The Nation excluding Trump's lead and choosing to focus on the fact that Trump has now lost to Biden twice in Wisconsin. So the next time your cousin from a conservative swing state goes on and on about Trump's poll numbers, you'll know where he's getting his information. Personally, I love the blind spot feature. This is a special feature where I can see stories that are under or over reported. It ensures that I see stories like this one about Trump, so I'm well informed. Plus, don't miss the Ground News 2024 election page where you can stay up to date on all the latest election news and see blind spot stories to know both sides of the story. So click the link in the description or go to ground.news/Legia and sign up through my link this month to get 40% off unlimited access and help an independent team keep the media transparent. Thanks, Ground News. In January 2024, a poll from Suffolk University found that Trump led Biden by 3 percentage points, with independent Robert F. Kennedy Jr. taking 10% of the vote. 2 months later, in March of this year, that same survey found Trump leading by just 2%, with RFK falling to 9% of the vote and 5% of voters still undecided. 1/3 of respondents said the U.S. is in an economic recovery, a drastic uptick from July 2022, when only 9% said the same. For 29% of voters, the economy is the most important issue on voters' minds, followed by immigration at 24%, threats to democracy at 23%, abortion at 10%, and the Israel-Hamas conflict at 3%. And in case your echo chamber bubble is as thick and contained as mine is, let me repeat. Only 3% of respondents said the Israel-Hamas conflict was the most important issue on their minds. That is not what my echo chamber would have me believe, so I wanted to highlight it. Anyway, with the economy the number one issue on the most people's minds and a growing perception that we are in an economic recovery, that still translates to Trump leading by 2 percentage points. But the survey was taken in March. The election isn't until November. 8 months is a long time in a presidential election campaign. How much stock can we even put in these numbers? How should we be reading them? The media certainly loves to report on them as though it's a neck-and-neck horse race we can't look away from, but is this really what we should be spending our time paying attention to? I'm gonna dive into political polling in this country, how it started, how it's changed in the 21st century, and how it's conducted to set the stage for how we got it so wrong in 2016, how polling has changed in response to Donald Trump, and whether you should actually be putting stock in any of the poll numbers you see leading up to the election. At the beginning of the 20th century, politicians generally measured public opinion by what was printed in the newspapers. Polling and surveys were relatively unsophisticated and shallow. Newspapers and political parties would take general surveys of how people said they expected to vote, but there was little attention paid to how well the samples actually represented the public, and there was nothing sophisticated about how those numbers were interpreted. Early at the turn of the century, advertisers began taking questionnaires to research consumer preferences, and the first modern poll was deployed in 1932 by psychologist Henry Link. Using more sophisticated measurement methods, it was called a psychological barometer, again for advertisement purposes. The first modern poll tested consumer attitudes towards soap, coffees, and other goods. Soon, public opinion analysts took these psychological barometers and applied them to public opinion polls, most notably Gallup and Roper, who turned their polling into full-blown businesses that established their founders as household names. However, behind the scenes, there was a man who predated Gallup and Roper, who was using more sophisticated polling methods, and who had a direct line to the ear of the president. In 1932, a jowly, somber, 40-something, self-taught statistician named Emil Herja wrote a letter to the Democratic National Committee explaining how he would employ a definite method of statistical control and analysis of political sentiment during the coming campaign for FDR. He would gather data, and then, since the polls weren't perfectly representative of the whole electorate, he would re-weight them for greater accuracy. He would then analyze the data to pinpoint which battleground states and counties could be won with the proper resources. This is just how polls are done now, but at the time, it was more detailed and controlled than anyone else was doing. He understood key concepts that still underscore political polling: the importance of random sampling to ensure the surveyed group wasn't skewed, the need for weighting or correcting for over or underrepresented demographic groups, and the need to focus on likely voters instead of just registered voters by looking at turnout in previous elections. And on the Friday before the election day, 1932, Herja not only forecast a revolution at the ballot box in favor of FDR, he predicted that FDR would win the popular vote with a margin of 7.5 million votes. The final number was 7.2 million. Roosevelt's win and Herja's successful predictions made him a very famous man. By 1934, Herja was executive director of the DNC, where he once again helped win midterm elections across the country with his polling. When FDR won re-election in 1936, scientific polling was solidified as the standard for running campaigns. However, that was the end of Herja's winning streak. He predicted FDR would lose his bid for a historic third term, which FDR went on to win, and with Gallup and others solidifying their household name status throughout the country with their polling businesses, Emil Herja faded into relative historical obscurity. But his methods live on in how polling continues to be conducted in this country. Since Emil Herja, the biggest upset to shake up political polling in this country has been the advent of the internet and the simultaneous growth of the 24-hour news cycle. 30 years ago, polls were conducted via telephone to landlines across the country. Pollsters had access to a random sample of phone numbers. Usually there was someone home to pick up the phone, and often people would be excited to answer questions because they were being posed by reputable news services, and people liked the attention. It felt like a big deal. Now, however, a lot has changed. Very few people have landline phones, and very few people answer unknown numbers on their cell phones. The inundation of spammy phone calls has us all feeling wary of talking to anyone if we do answer the phone. And increasingly, because of sharp cutbacks in funding for news media, the typical, recognizable news sources are now turning to private survey companies and buying surveys from them instead of hiring reporters and editors to conduct their own polls. So not only are we fatigued by spam calls, we also don't know who these companies are that are calling us and requesting that we answer a short survey. Everyone has a short survey for us to fill out. We are overwhelmed, and we don't have the bandwidth for all these requests on our time. In fact, telephone survey response rates have fallen below 9%. Online surveying is more accessible but can prove even more problematic, as there's no national list of email addresses to pull samples, so there's no traditional way to collect a probability sample of the general population through online surveys. On top of all of this, there is a growing feeling of distrust in the media, especially on the right of the political spectrum, so the types of people who are even willing to respond to these polls are becoming more and more skewed and less representative of the population. Traditionally, the way that pollsters account for this skewing is by taking the data that they've collected and weighing certain factors based on what they know through the larger U.S. Census data. So, for example, if in their survey of 1,000 people, 200 of them lived in California, but we know based on the U.S. Census that only 11% of the population lives in California, then they may put a different weight on those scores to even out the population. However, this is as much an art as it is a science, and a lot of this weighing comes down to educated guesswork. It's one thing to take a sample poll of the public sentiment around the economy, for example, and then weigh the responses based on census data. That gives us a good idea of the general population as a whole and how they feel about the economy. But it's another thing to take a sample poll to predict the outcome of a presidential election. Then the existing census data is less helpful because it's not about controlling for the population as a whole. It's about controlling for the population of potential voters. And whether or not someone votes is often left up to chance until a few days before the election, if that. So you may have a survey of 1,000 people and 200 of them are in California, but controlling for how many of those people actually vote in the upcoming election is impossible. Pollsters try to get as close as possible by also asking participants about their registration status and past voting behavior, the idea being that if you're registered to vote and you have voted in past elections, then you are a likely voter in the upcoming election. But this is not hard and fast science. In fact, there is demonstrated behavior called social desirability, in which respondents to surveys can be easily influenced not only by the way the person hears or sees a question, as well as the way questions are framed and organized in the survey, but they can also be swayed to answer a question based on what they think the surveyor wants to hear. In a democracy, voting is generally seen as a virtuous activity. So when a real-life human calls you and says, hey, are you planning on voting? You might feel influenced to say yes, even if you're not sure or you have no plan to, just so you don't feel guilty by admitting that you don't know or don't plan to vote at all in the first place. It's all guesswork and estimation, and there's no way to know exactly how a pollster weighted certain answers and how that pollster's choices affected the final numbers in the poll, unless they're forthcoming about their methodology. But because the news media are operating on shoestring budgets while also needing to fill 24 hours of news cycles every day, and because of the increasing pressure to be the first to report on something, that means that they are looking at every news survey that comes out and reporting on it as if it is hard and fast data, as if it means anything other than what it is, a snapshot in time of what pollsters guess the majority of Americans are feeling based on answers given to them by a sample size of probably 1,000 to 2,000 Americans, any number of whom might not even end up voting come November. And it was this fancy guesswork that led so many people to get it so very wrong in 2016. By 2016, this issue with landline phone calls and representative sampling was already widely known. To compensate, many firms conducted both phone call surveys as well as other survey methods to try to estimate who would win the presidential election that year. Even so, as the poll numbers started coming in, weighted and manipulated behind the scenes by pollsters based on what they thought they knew about the electorate, they were all showing that Hillary Clinton would win. A HuffPost poll on Election Day concluded that Hillary Clinton had a 98% chance of beating Trump. 538 predicted that Clinton had a 71% chance of winning. That echoed a lot of other polls leading up to and on the day of the election in 2016. And most people who felt that a Clinton victory was all but insured in 2016 because of these poll numbers and also because it seems obvious that Trump is an unelectable buffoon were left absolutely dumbfounded the night of the election as it became clearer and clearer that Trump would, in fact, be the next president of the United States. Why didn't we see this coming? How did we get it so wrong in 2016? Is polling completely irrelevant in the age of Trump and the internet? Here's what happened. For one, Trump voters introduced a new variable into the electorate, one that pollsters didn't know to control for. Education. Pollsters grossly underestimated the number of older white men with high school educations or less who would show up to vote for Trump. These men were especially prevalent in the Midwestern battleground states where Clinton was slated to win, but Trump ended up winning by narrow margins. And some of these men do not traditionally vote at all and are only compelled to vote when Trump is running, creating an electorate makeup unique to Trump. The other error that pollsters made in their predictions was with the Latino vote. The sampling of Latino voters used in polls typically skewed higher income and in non-Latino districts. Pollsters failed to account for the number of working class and poorer Latinos who would show up and vote for Trump. Again, Trump introduced new variables into the electorate that pollsters failed to control for because in the end, these pre-election polls are simply educated guesses that amount to an art as much as, if not more so, than a science. That being said, however, it would be unfair to say that the pollsters got it completely wrong in 2016. We were all shook, certainly, but they did accurately predict that Clinton would win the popular vote. She did, by 3 million votes. But our country does not use simple majority voting to determine the president. The polls failed to capture the potential outcomes in states where Trump won slim victories that allowed him to gain the requisite number of electors, even while Clinton technically won more total popular votes. Even so, the upset of the 2016 election left many people wary of believing the polls they see ahead of Election Day. The Hill published a survey in 2018 that showed that 52% of Americans don't believe that polls are accurate. So with all of this hullabaloo over the polling results in 2016 and greater skepticism in the electorate of any polling results at all, did the pollsters learn from their mistakes and get it right in 2020? Well, yes and no. Pre-election polls in 2020 correctly forecast that Biden would win a popular and electorate vote majority over Trump. However, the size of Biden's victory fell far short of expectations generated by much of the polling, and Republican candidates for other offices fared far better than polling indicated that they would. In fact, by some estimates, the polling error in the 2020 election was the highest in 40 years. Because even if a poll accurately stated that Biden would win, that does not reflect the overall accuracy of the poll. If one poll said Trump would win by 1 percentage point, and another said Biden would win by 20 percentage points, the second poll would technically be right because Biden won, but the accuracy would be much worse than the poll that said Trump would win by 1%, if we're looking at how close the estimate was in actual numbers of voters. And that matters. It's inaccurate to say the second poll was more accurate than the first poll just because it chose the right winner. And because the polls overestimated the degree to which Biden would win the election in 2020, they were deemed to be even less accurate than the 2016 polls. In 2020, pollsters did learn from their mistakes in 2016. They began to weigh responses based on education level to account for the number of less educated white men who were voting for Trump. Yet their numbers were still skewed, and it's impossible to know why. It's likely a number of factors, such as responses from too few Republicans, differences in the kinds of Republicans who did and did not respond, and the number and kinds of new voters who did and did not respond to these surveys. There isn't great knowledge at this point of who isn't taking part in these polls, but there does appear to be a pattern. In 2018 and 2022, both midterm years when Trump was not on the ballot, polls were much more accurate in determining the outcomes of the elections. In 2016 and 2020, the polls were incredibly inaccurate. This suggests that we have a unique Trump problem. That is, the types of people who turn out to vote for Trump likely include people who do not participate in pre-election surveys, or frankly, any other aspect of civic life, and people who typically do not show up to vote at all, but are compelled to do so because of Trump. But because these people do not tend to respond to surveys of any kind, likely due to their distrust of the media and of institutions of higher education, both of which have been vilified by the far right, we have very little data about their behavior, who they vote for, and how many of these people exist. This means that participation in pre-election surveys, once a thing that people typically were open to because they trusted the surveying entity and generally enjoyed the attention and were available to answer questions on their landline phone, has been politicized to the point that whether or not you respond to a survey at all is an indication of your political leanings. This makes it very difficult to predict the behavior and numbers of the people who do not respond, which, knowing the general attitude of Trump supporters, is likely the very reason they won't respond to these surveys. They don't want people to know their business. Basically, a Trump ballot throws a number of wrenches and unaccountable factors into the mix that makes any pre-election poll more inaccurate than other election years. Add to this the other third-party candidates making a bid for the presidency and the confusion of Trump's current legal status as a potential future convict, and you've got a perfect storm for 2024 to be the least predictable election on record. So with all of this in mind, how much stock can you actually put in these polls that are predicting who will win an election that's over 6 months away at this point, featuring a candidate whose supporters notoriously are difficult to predict? Well, not much. It would be a different story altogether if the polls were showing one candidate ahead of the other one by a pretty dramatic margin. But polls become less and less accurate the closer to a tie a race is. And right now, most of the polls are showing that Trump and Biden are within a couple percentage points of each other. And this brings up an important point with poll numbers. Margin of error. Any poll worth anything will include its methodology and margin of error along with the numbers. The typical poll has a margin of error of plus or minus about 3%, though that's just accounting for statistical sources of error like sampling issues. Additional errors in biases, weighting, and poll techniques are less quantifiable, and therefore the margin of error could be much higher. But even if the margin of error were a perfect plus or minus 3%, that means that these polls showing Trump and Biden within 2 to 3 percentage points of each other are meaningless. Additionally, with 5% of the electorate reporting that they're undecided, these small margins could change drastically on election day when undecided voters have to make a decision. So basically, at this point, the error rate of these polls combined with how close the race is, you might as well flip a coin and your likelihood of guessing right would be the equivalent. So with the level of anxiety that people are feeling about the upcoming election, and many of us looking to the poll numbers as if they're a crystal ball that can tell our future, what information can we use to help us try to understand what might happen in November? Political scientists recommend looking at odds rather than polling. Look to the fundamentals, not the polls. The first fundamental, incumbents usually win. They haven't 3 times since Carter, but usually they do. If this were a midterm year, the other fundamental would be that the party out of the White House tends to do better, though that of course wasn't true in 2022. The thing thing that most political scientists are looking at this far out, however, are the fundamental numbers that tend to predict voter sentiment better than a poll asking them who they'll vote for in 8 months. Those are numbers related to the economy, how it's actually doing, consumer sentiment, unemployment numbers. And so looking at polls as a way to identify trends across time, especially in the economy, is much more useful this far out than looking at polls to predict who will win the presidency. At the beginning, I told you that a Suffolk University poll found that between January and March, Trump went from 3 points ahead of Biden to 2 points ahead of Biden. That same poll in March found that 33% of Americans feel optimistic about the economy. When asked the same question in June 2022, that number was 9%. So in the time Biden has been in office, we've seen a jump of 24 percentage points in consumer confidence in the economy. That's a positive trend that bodes well for Biden. And because consumer sentiment is much easier to control for, we're just trying to predict how everyone generally feels, not how people will actually vote 8 months from now, those numbers tend to be more accurate and can be relied upon to get a general idea of voter sentiment, which is more helpful for predicting outcomes this far out than any poll predicting who will win the election could be. As the election draws nearer, the ability to predict the winner will become a little greater as undecided voters make up their minds and the sentiment about the economy and other pressing issues is more clear. So if you are looking at polls predicting a winner closer to the day of the election, here's what to look for to make sure the poll data you're reading is actually reliable. Is it from a reputable source? According to 538, here are the top most accurate pollsters: the New York Times, Siena College, ABC News, The Washington Post, Marquette University Law School, and Suffolk University. Some of the least accurate pollsters to look out for include Ascend Action, Amber Integrated, Moore Information Group, and the Trafalgar Group. What is the margin of error? And do they even share it? How many points off do the pollsters think they are? Typically, that number is around plus or minus 3 percentage points, but it can be as high as 6 or 7%. If that's the case, a poll showing a 2 or 3 point lead for either candidate means very little. And if the source doesn't even share their margin of error, that's a big red flag. This is where the media often falls short, reporting on polls like it's a horse race, but not also reporting on the margin of error that could be affecting the accuracy of the poll. What's their methodology? How big is the sample size, and how did they weight the answers? This can reveal the limitations of a poll. Is it just 1,000 college students? 200 randomly selected people? And if this methodology is not shared by the pollster, that's another red flag. Keeping an eye on these factors will make you a more savvy consumer of poll data. That being said, the reality is that a lot will change between now and election day. And even a couple weeks or even a few days before the election, change is constant, and many things can affect voter turnout, sentiment, and day of decisions. The real takeaway I want you to get from this video is that maybe looking at polls trying to predict the outcome of a presidential election isn't the right use of our time and attention, because in the end, they're just not very accurate in today's political landscape where elections are won by a razor-thin margin, and the electorate is less predictable than ever. Polls give the media something shiny to latch onto and new numbers every month to report on, which feeds our desire to feel like there are savvy people out there analyzing who's up and who's down, the spin, the strategy, but none of that actually provides voters with information they can use to critically evaluate what's going on and what's at issue in an election. It can be very easy to confuse quantification with precision. Let me say that again. It can be very easy to confuse quantification with precision. You see numbers and percentages and you think, ooh, math, fancy. But just because we have the Nate Silvers of the world sitting behind the scenes, crunching numbers and doing highly complicated statistical analyses, and we have the map daddies on the night of the election closely watching the exit polls, doesn't mean we have a silver ball that can see into the future and tell us what will happen in November. Our time is much better spent informing ourselves on the issues that matter to us and our elected representatives' work and stances on those issues, on paying attention to local politics, more than sitting around hand-wringing over the latest poll saying Trump will win in November. The reality is, no one knows, and we simply can't know. So better to work for the outcome we want than to sit around hoping the polls will fix it for us. Thank you to my Patreon community and my YouTube members for supporting the work that goes into making these videos week after week. You might have noticed that we are in a slightly different space these days. If you want to see some behind-the-scenes content of the new studio space, or if you're looking to get early access to ad-free, uncensored versions of my videos, consider checking out my Patreon community or clicking the big join button below to become a member here on YouTube. You'll be supporting my work and getting access to special extra content as well. The extra content is the same whether you join as a YouTuber YouTube member, or on Patreon. Your support helps to keep these videos free for everyone and further our mission towards legal and political education for all. Shout out to my newest supporters, as well as supporters in my royal tiers, and a very special shout out to my multi-platinum supporters, Latranger Lucas, Joshua Cole, Thomas Johnson, Sophia Sams, Anthony Giles, and Brett Piontek. Your generosity makes this channel what it is, so thank you. If you liked this video, you'll also like my last video, all about how our collective distraction is bad for democracy. Thanks so much for watching. Have a good day. Bye-bye.